Accession number 27803, Mr. Vic Stone, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about your time at number 3 Air Gunnery School from July 1943. Now, the next part of your training, after the ground training, was you went up in Anson's on sort of real training.
Anson's were used.
Now, what did you think of the Anson's? Could you sort of describe them and what you thought of them?
It was a very reliable aircraft. It's quite an old one, the Anson, American one, but it was very reliable. On occasions, if it did happen to crash into the sea, it did float very well, which was a very good thing. Just offshore, there was some workings where they were taking these sand buggies out to load barges, and they had cables running out from shore to the barges, or to the derricks by the barges. So the barges waited underneath. These overhead railway tracks ran out, carrying the sand, emptied it into the barges, and went back again. You could not always see these cables. If the weather was bad, you couldn't see the cables which were running out to sea. And on one occasion when I was there, one of the aircraft did catch his wing on the cables coming in, landed in the water, but there were no casualties. Everybody managed to get out okay. I think eventually they did salvage the aircraft. I'm not over sure about that, but probably did, because couldn't afford to leave them there, could they, in the water, and it wasn't all that deep, not inshore.
Now tell me about the training you got when you were in the Anson. What would you do?
You went out. You had ammunition was coloured for each person that went out, so that having fired your allocated number of rounds, whatever it was, 200, 300, 400, 500, when you came back and they came back with the...
Hang on, what were you firing at and where were you firing from?
From the Anson, yes. From the turret in the Anson.
Turret?
Yeah. From the turret in the Anson, yes, that's right.
Now, what kind of turret was it?
I think it was a Fraser Nash. I'm not over sure about that. No, I'm not over sure about it. The guns were Browning 303, I know that, yes. There was five or six of us went on the aircraft. There could have been more, I don't really remember how many, but... and we used to take it in turns. There was an aircraft which towed a drogue, which is like a very large sock. Now, that flew on a parallel course with us, some distance away, quite obviously. And when we were told to fire, we get in the turret, get comfortable, and we were given the signal to fire. Everything was ready to fire. And we used to fire the guns from the Anson towards this drogue that was being towed by the aircraft. When all the men are on board the Anson and had their turn at using the guns and firing their ammunition, both aircraft would return. They would land. The drogue would be taken off the aircraft. It would be taken to the armory. And there it would be examined for the bullet holes which were in it, and also the markings of them to see which bullets were fired by any particular person. You were given the scores. I don't know what the scores were. I think they were reasonably well. You're given the scores, then you don't make a note of them or marks of them. You're just told they're good. When you leave the gunnery school, you're assessed to how good you were on the course.
You also use cine film sometimes, cine cameras.
I never used camera guns at night time. I think mainly these. I think you see there were quite a lot of people going through the gunnery school at the same time. A lot of people were just going to be strict air gunners. So therefore, I think they used the turrets more at night time than we did, because in their air firing...
No, camera guns.
Yeah, camera guns, yes. Yeah.
Why would they only be used at night time? I thought they'd be used in the daytime more.
Not necessarily, no. They would use them at night because on the guns, they had a sight, and the site had a, as far as I can call it, had a round red ring in it. And you had to get the drogue within this ring before you fired. Hard to am I describing
it? Seems
correctly?
Clear, okay.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. No, I think, as I was saying, that I think it used they used more for the people who were going to use the turrets more at night time. We were just going to be, in other words, a spare gunner if a gunner was needed. If the gunner got injured or something, well, then we would be there, we would know what to do, and we could take over. That was our mainly why we became WOP AGs rather than just wireless operators.
So it's just a spare course.
Yeah, that's a spare course, yes.
What about recreation, sir? What did you have fun?
Recreation, not a lot on the island. Very small island is Anglesey. We used to get a bus or a train across the Menai Strait into Bangor, it used to be. That was the main town. Quite a nice little town. In those years, of course, we're talking of 60-odd years ago. It's much smaller than no doubt it is now. Very, very friendly people. Very friendly people. A lot spoke their language instead of our language, but also a lot spoke our language as well as their language, and that was a great help. We would go into town. Maybe we'd go to a cinema, but we didn't do this very often. If there was a dance on camp, which they used to put on for entertainment sometimes, we will go to the dance hall. We go also to the mainland. If we could get transport to the mainland, we will go. The service laid on a crew bus for us. It was a limited amount of people, obviously, so you put your name down for the crew bus, and if you'd been once that week, they'd hope that you wouldn't put your name down and go again. And
now, one thing I know, sir, is there's a lot of kerfuffle about going for a dance. It's quite a nice story. Would you tell us that?
Yes. Well, when we went into Bangor, obviously, we were always looking for cups of tea. Everybody wanted a cup of tea, so we thought we'd go into Woolworths, because in Woolworths they have two different girls serving behind the tea counters in there. So we went in there. We thought this is a good idea to chat up the girls, and we went in there, but the day that we went in wasn't a particularly good day, so we decided, well, we would withdraw from this particular day and go when it wasn't so busy. We would go there, we'd have a chat, order a cup of tea and have a chat, and then, of course, if they were reasonably busy, we ordered another cup of tea, because there was a supervisor there. She used to come around and make sure the girls weren't chatting all the time, make sure they were looking after the other customers. Eventually, we did manage to get one or two of these young ladies to give their consent to come to a dance. We did meet on the Saturday night, walked up the hillside in the dark, obviously. Eventually, found this hall. It was just, I suppose it could have been a village hall, a church hall. It's just a small hall. A little band in there, probably all the locals who were played instruments, and very austere room. There were just stalls or like benches around the edges, and we sat down. We had a walk around the floor, more or less to talk to the girls. Of an evening, if you're enjoying yourself, it always goes quick, doesn't it? So the evening passed quite quickly. Having been to the dance, it finished, I think it was around about 11 o'clock, I'm not sure, and the crew bus, I think we had about 15 minutes to get to the crew bus, so we all dashed down the town, and luckily enough, the bus station there, there was one or two buses in which the girls needed to catch, so they caught their buses home. We got the crew bus and went back to camp. We used to occasionally go across on the train, but as I say, we didn't visit there an awful lot, because there wasn't an awful lot for us to do there, bearing in mind that money was a little bit scarce in those days as well. On camp, we would spend the evenings in the naffy a lot of the time. We'd play cards, we played dominoes, many drafts. We used to play many things in those days in different games in the pubs, which they don't play now. Very Well, if they even heard of them, they wouldn't know what they're talking about. One was a little game called Tippet, and that was all done sort of under the table, where you maybe six of you either side of the table, and you'd have a coin or something in your hand, and you had to tap it underneath the table and give intimations that you were passing it on, and the opposite side had to guess where the coin was. Silly game, isn't it? We're going back to silly times when we used to play tiddlywinks. But we used to have some very, very good evenings in the mess. They had a piano in there. A lot of the evenings you get somebody come in. There was always somebody who could play the piano, and they'd always give a tune on the piano, and we'd have a sing song. Yes, there was a couple of snooker tables in there, as I can recall, in one room there. It was a problem to get on them, but nobody seemed to fight over them, nobody seemed to argue about them. There didn't seem to be any bad feeling at all with anybody if they couldn't get on the table. If they couldn't use the table, they go to the darts board, or if they couldn't use the darts board, they go and play cribbage, which was another popular game in those days.
Now, anything else about the course?
No. Mainly, I think I mainly covered the course itself with the way that we were taught with the guns, how to disassemble them, how to reassemble them.
Was there a test at the end, or you passed anyway?
Oh, yes. There was an obvious test at the end, you see. Whatever you did, you had marks for, and at the end of the course, you were assessed and you were given an overall figure. 45, 50, 55, 60, whatever it was, percentage it was. They had a set figure, which I don't know which it was, but there's a set figure which you had to pass. Probably on my notes there, on my service record, it may even say...
somewhere in there, yeah.
Yes, how good I was at gunnery. If it's very good, you may look at it. If not, I'll turn over the page.
Now, what happened? You're also promoted to sergeant.
Yes.
At that point, September 43.
Before we left there, we passed the gunnery course, so therefore we became Wireless Op AG sergeant. Yes, I think the date of that you'll find in my. On that one that's open.
September.
I think it's probably opened at the page, I don't know, but it gives you the date there. And also I got quite a nice little rise then.
So your next thing is in you have some more leave?
Yes, a few days. I can't remember. We used to have perhaps 5 days leave, 7 days, it may be eight. It all depended where we were going to go and whether they were ready to accept us.
And so the next place you go to is number 42 OT Operational Training Unit at Ashbourne.
Ashbourne in Derbyshire, that's right, yes.
Now,
yes.
I believe you had trouble getting there from London.
Yes, very, very, very awkward journey. I was messed about on the trains. I just missed one, and one was disrupted. I don't know which one that was. One was disrupted. Eventually, I did get to Derby and managed to talk to a man who was a lorry driver. He was taking some goods. I don't know where he was taking them. He was taking some goods somewhere and offered me a lift, which I was very, very pleased of. He said, "I'll go past the camp." He said, "So if you'd like a lift, you're very welcome to have one." So I jumped aboard the lorry, and a little bit cold ride, but however. We did manage to get there. Very, very late at night it was. The guard room again, you always have to go to the guard room to report in. The people at the guard room should have a note there that you are due to arrive at 23:59, it always was, 1 minute before midnight. That's the time you had to arrive. It was up to them to find you your accommodation then, which was already allocated to you. They wouldn't leave the guard room, obviously, but they'd get on the telephone and get somebody to come over and show you where your quarters were. You were shown your quarters, and if you wanted something to eat or drink, you could go down the mess and you can always get a bit of supper if you wanted it. Other than that, you'd turn in for the night.
Now, what was your accommodation like as a sergeant?
Nothing exceptional, and obviously much better than the others, no doubt, because there probably weren't so many beds in the room. But quite a long room, more like a squared hat type rather than the Nissen. A lot of them had Nissens, but these were like the squared type of hat. I think it was 14, 16, I don't know really how many were in there. As you went into the hut, on one side there was a room which was the orderly sergeant's. On the other side was a room that housed all the blankets and all the cleaning equipment. The beds were comfortable, palliasses obviously, but very, very comfortable in the circumstances of which we were living. The ablutions were at the far end. You went into the front in past the two rooms, which, as I say, was like a storeroom, and the orderly sergeants. You went right through the hut, and at the far end were the ablutions, the toilets and everything. Hot water was always there. It was always nice to get hot water. There was plenty of space in there. No matter what time you went in there in the morning, you could always get space. Mostly you were up at the same time as a lot of the lads. You get one or two would get up much earlier than you. You get one or two who would still be laying in bed when the sergeant put his head round the door.
What was going on at the operational training unit? What sort of training or what was going on? What was the purpose of the unit?
Yes, well, operational training unit, it is, as it says, it trains you in all aspects for operations. You get crewed up with a pilot and a navigator. In those days we had five in the crew.
Now, when did this happen? Did this happen straight away or did it happen?
Within a few days of you being there, yes. There was always the preliminaries which took up a couple of days, you know. But
what kind of preliminaries?
You were shown around where the different quarters were, a rough idea of the layout of the camp. That was the main thing to show you. And then when you were crewed up, of course.
Now, this is not what you've got in your memoirs. In your memoirs, you've got that you've spent 2 weeks on basic training in classrooms and then were formed into a crew. That's why I'm asking.
Oh, did I? Oh, well, maybe it was a couple of weeks in training. Yes. That there will be probably more right than I'm thinking at the moment. Because when I was doing that, that probably took me 2 or 3 hours to do one page of that when I sit and visualise. But sitting here, going through it is more difficult to get everything into prospectus.
There seem to have been separate classes for pilots, navigators, etc. Before you went into the crew pool, which is where you... and it particularly mentions a link trainer. I don't know whether you cast your mind back. We've not got many good descriptions of a link trainer.
Yes, a link trainer, this is something that... This is all part of the training. This is all part of the preliminary training, you see.
What was a link trainer?
The link trainer, you've probably seen them at a fair or somewhere. It is... It's supposed to be built as an aircraft. It's built and they use them for training these astronauts now. They can swivel in every direction, up, down, left, right. They're a very complicated piece of machinery. You enter this machinery, and I call it machinery, but we'll say the aircraft. You enter this aircraft and you sit in a seat there. In front of you is a screen, and you've got the controls, something similar to you'd have in an aircraft. Not exactly, because all aircraft are different. You sit in this trainer, and then the instructor will call out over the intercom to you, and he'll tell you... about to the course you're going to take, where you're going to go to, what course to set, He won't tell you the length of the... I don't think he tells you the length of the flying... No, I don't think he does tell you that.
And are you actually flying it? I mean,
yes, actually. And then they...
Well, not flying, but they will start the flying controls.
Yes, and then they will tell you all the preliminaries, first of all, what you've got to do, where you're going to go, everything. They'll give you all the instructions, and then they will switch on this machine, which is it's like an aircraft. If you must have seen one of these somewhere in a museum or somewhere.
And why were you
somewhere.
Doing this? Because you weren't going to be a pilot.
No, but this is, strange enough, all parts of the course. It's all a part of the course. Whether everybody has to have it to give you an idea of if you've got into problems. It's one of these things, if you're told to do it, you do it.
How well did you do on it? Was it difficult?
It was fairly difficult, yes. It was fairly difficult because when you're in there, the controls respond slightly. They may respond quicker on a left or starboard turn to a port turn than they would to an up or a down movement. They seem sluggish and some they seemed easy, but of course that it depends on the speed of the air, on the speed, doesn't it? You see, if you're going down, obviously the speed tends to increase. If you're going up, the speed tends to decrease, and you've got to allow for all these. Yeah. It is a very interesting piece of machinery, very, very interesting. Now you can understand why all these children queue up in these fates and fairs and to get inside. When you come back, you're told or you're shown on a graph exactly how you did, whether you did right, whether you came back, whether you landed in the sea, whether you landed on the airfield, whether you landed on the runway or in next door's field or wherever you landed. Yes, it's.
Now you also seem to have been using more some experience in more advanced radio sets, the in-service ones, I suppose.
Yes, well, I can't remember the original ones, but I think they were 1082s or something. They were quite old ones, but then we went over to these Marconi ones, and the Marconi ones were the more modern ones, and the ones, as far as I know, that we still use. I was still using them in November 1944, which was getting towards the end of the war, so I can only assume they must have been the same ones they were using then.
How different were they?
They were much easier in that on the old ones, you had valves and you had to carry whole lots of valves and coils and things. These you didn't have to carry anything at all. Everything was contained in the radio itself. One advantage was these, that when you were sending messages... on the old one, you could not send. You had to wait till a message had been sent before you could receive one. This you could interrupt them. If you'd missed something, you could interrupt them and say, "Could you go back to so and so and so?" You got a say. You got a message come through, and it says. Return to base, etc., via so and so because of this. If you haven't got all the message, you can just stop the message and you just tap out IMI, did it, da da da, did it. And that says, that's interrogation. We're asking you, what did you say? And then we say after, and we give the last word that we got. So we ask them, what did you say after that word? And then they will repeat that, and you can carry on again. And it's much, much simpler. Much easier to tune as well. Very, very much easier.
Now, you also seem to have been doing some familiarisation flights in the Whitley Mark III with Polish pilots. I mean, not with the pilots you're going to crew up with in the pilots pool, but with other,
Well, first of all, when you're taken up, you go with them. Your pilot would be with you, but you have another pilot, an instructor pilot, because bearing in mind this is the first time that this, like our pilot, would be flying Whitley aircraft. You see, so he's got to get acclimatised.
This is before the crews formed, though.
Sorry?
This is before the crews formed. I think it may be...
Well, you do get one or two... sort of familiarisation flights, but I think they are mainly just to get you what the aircraft looks like, where your place is. They are not part of the actual course. They are additionals. You can put them in as additionals. They are not part of the actual course. When you get a crew, then you go as a crew. You all go
well,
as a crew.
Well, let's move on.
Then you have a pilot.
Now, what did you before on the familiarisation flights? What did you think of the Whitley Mark III?
Not a lot, really. Not a lot. They were very slow, cumbersome sort of aircraft. Very difficult to get out of if you had a problem. Always flew with the impression that their nose was pointing down to the ground. No, they were nothing special. I mean, they were used during the war as bombers earlier in the war, so they must have proved themselves one way or other earlier on, before the later bombers came in, before the four engine ones came in.
Now, what about the formation of your crew? How was it done? Were you assigned to a crew, or
that,
did you?
You know that I cannot honestly remember. I can remember going into this pool. It was called a pool, P-O-O-L, and you're in a pool. It's A, B, C, D, whatever. You're in a pool, and then.
So you joined the crew as a wireless operator air gunner.
That's right. Yes.
Do you remember who? You've got them here. I don't want to test you, but your pilot was Sergeant Farthing.
Tony Farthing. Yes. Sorry.
Now, what was he like? What? Why him? You don't remember how you joined.
Well, I don't remember how.
What was he like?
No. He was very nice lad. He's only 20 years old, I think he was. Very nice lad. Came from Eastbourne. Finished his training. Obviously, came to the OTU at the same time as I did. Waiting for a crew, the same as I was, and him and I got together. How the other crew came to us, I really don't know, but they came through the same channels. The bombardment would have come from the school and the.
Well, let's go through the. What about the navigator? That's Flight Sergeant Richard Stevenson. What was he like?
Yes. He was. He's a very nice guy. He had quite a few ops under his belt. I can't remember how many. He had quite a few ops under his belt, but he had a terrifying experience before he came to us. He was in a Boston bomber, and it overshot the runway and exploded. But he wanted to carry on flying. Yes, he came to us. He's a very, very good navigator as such, as he proved himself when we used to fly. The bomb aimer. He was a.
That's Sergeant John Hancock.
That's right. Yes, he was a seemed a very shy sort of a person, very introvert. I suppose you call him very nice though, very nice, very very competent in his job. Obviously, otherwise he wouldn't have passed out and come to us. How we got him, I really don't know. And then there was. Des.
Now, how did you get on with these men? Did you get on with them well straight away? Because I know you got another crew later, but this was at the time you'd have thought this was going to be who you'd go to war with. I mean, how did you relate with them?
We got on very well. When we went out socially, we'd all go out together. We would stay together. You know, we were going to have a drink. We never used to drink a lot. I think this is when we first started to drink, when they used to go down to the local pub. They used to say, we're going down to Ashbourne, coming down there. And it was a nice little village. We got to know friends. We met a lot of people there, friendly people there. And we used to go down there most nights. We didn't drink a lot, but we used to go down there most nights to see them. Or if we didn't go in the pub, we'd go in the YMCA and see the ladies in there. There's one or two ladies in there we got quite friendly with. There was another, I think it was a TOC H. I can't remember, but there was some other organisation there which we used to visit as well.